2:40, but we know time, it's a week time period. I'll be talking about, first, about some work which has been done in collaboration with CIRRUT from the Paris Observatory. I've been weekly involved with the first topic. It's mainly by Sebastian Biz and his group. And then I'll talk about some work I've been doing, analyzing some data for LPI with from some data from the Paris Observatory. Then I'll talk about some experiments at the University of Western Australia, which we're doing there, and their Lorentz invariance tests. And hopefully it won't take too long. So Sebastian sent me his slides, so I could, which was a talk, which I'm co-author, but I don't know as much as about this subject as the other parts of the topic, but I'll still give it. And this is on the temporal variations of fundamental constants using the atomic clocks they have at the Paris Observatory. And our collaboration with CIRRUT began a long time ago when we transported one of our oscillators, cryogenic sapphire oscillators, to their laboratory. I went there with a PhD student, we installed it, and it's been working there for quite a long time. And now it's sort of the heart of the system with a hydrogen maser, and they're locked together and give a good local oscillator for most of the atomic clocks. And historically, first the microwave clocks based on cesium and rubidium, and of course now that they're developing optical clocks, and through the comb technology that makes possible these nice comparisons. So when we look at part of that ensemble of clocks, we can see where we can do some fundamental physics. In the past, we did local invariance tests with the sapphire oscillator and the hydrogen maser by comparisons there. And Victor came over to visit us earlier this year or last year, somewhere around then. And he got me interested in maybe looking for some LPI signals as well. And I've been analyzing some data, and I'll show that for the first time. Yeah, local position invariance. And of course, with all these atomic clocks, some of you might have seen some talks by the CIRRUT group on varying fundamental constants. And that part of the reason that their oscillators work well for these experiments is due to the interrogation oscillator that we provided. So how do fundamental constants vary? This goes back to work by Victor and his co-workers, and it's based on, you know, suggestion of very light scalar fields and maybe having of them in this form. And due to this, we could get very slow variations and maybe periodic variations where this Q is proportional to Gm on C squared. So that gives you the local position invariance and the drift in fundamental constants. Whoops. And due to his work, you've already seen quite a few talks on how these fundamental constants might relate to an experiment. So in different types of atomic clocks, will have different proportionalities to alpha and these other constants, and they've been calculated. And here's a table of some of the important proportionalities for the clocks at CIRRUT. And this is their latest results. I think their latest result is this point, which is a bit off zero. The publication before that was only up to here. And but still, it's not, it might have, there's maybe a bit of a systematic, I don't know, but it made results just close to the one standard deviation. And so you can look at, so yeah, that's their latest results, order of 10 to the minus 16 per year, which is an improvement by a factor of 3. And those results are over nearly 10 years. So there's been many experiments on these testing fundamental constants, and this is a summary that Sebastian produced. And of course, you'll hear about this result in the next talk. And the key thing is that optical frequency measurements were against cesium, and there's only two hyperfine transitions in these measurements, rubidium and cesium. And in the future, there'll be direct optical comparisons. So what they did with those results is use weighted least squares to try and uncorrelate the different fundamental constant drift. And this is the result. And the only problem is the correlation coefficients between these two results are quite big. So more different versatile experiments will probably be needed to totally uncorrelate these two results. So the more measurements, the better, in other words, in these type of experiments. Now I'll get to the topic which I had more to do with, and which I've just been working on, including yesterday in my hotel room last night. So this is local position invariance, and the idea is that as the Earth rotates around the Sun, there'll be a variation in gravitational field, and we've already heard that's on the order of 3%, I think. And you see, like, you can, what I did was I got a data of the perihelion and eighth perihelion results, and I plotted them with mean. This will be mean Julian day, not Julian day, and you can get a relationship between, there is such thing as Julian day. Mean Julian day is just, you know, it's really mean Julian day. That shows you I just did it yesterday. So what you'll see is that there's a, you can fit this Julian day to the annual phase, because each of these points represents pi phase, and then you get to here and it's pi on 2. So I can just graph them and get a model of the phase versus Julian day, and that's all I need. And the normalizing factor of here is this, which is 1.65 by 10 to the minus 10, which depends on the solar mass, the gravitational constant, speed of light, and eccentricity of the orbit. And what I do is I look for signals in phase and out of phase. So what did I use? I decided to look at the, we have continuously monitored the sapphire oscillator against the hydrogen maser, and back in 2003 we did a Kennedy-Thorndike experiment and have the best test on that type of Lorentz violation, and we also analyzed the results in for Lorentz violation in terms of the standard model extension and Robinson-Mansouri's sexual theory, which is a Kennedy-Thorndike term, and still have some of the best results. So I thought I would try and look for LPI signals in this. Of course, you could never get drift because this is a cavity and a cavity drifts. So you couldn't look for drift in fundamental constant, but you could look for variations. So you can search, there's two types, you can search for yearly variations for local position invariance, and you could search for annual, I mean, sorry, diurnal variations. And I'm doing both, actually, because the statistics over a day are much better than the statistics over a year. But nevertheless, huh?
How long did you collect?
We collected every 100 seconds.
No, the whole period.
The whole period?
Two years.
Yeah, we've been collecting it since 2002, but the duty cycle's not very good. from 2002 till the 26th of March 2003, and there's systematic jumps in the data due to changing hydrogen mazes and other things that I decided to not use the data before then, which are in some other publications. I thought the duty cycle wasn't enough. Because if you've got large gap between a set of data and data, that couldn't colour the, you know, there's problems with that in the data analysis, I believe. So here we have quite a good duty cycle. It's continuously, this comparison is continuously being done with a sapphire clock, sapphire oscillator.
Is it so stable?
It's very stable, it's just got drift.
Yes, that's what I mean. If you observe a finite time, you can have harmonics this time, and you can have a signal at any frequency. If you have very few periods. Let's say you observe three periods only, 3 years. After that, you can run a Fourier series, and that means.
Yeah, you'll see, I've got all that data. You're going to see a lot of data, you're going to see spectral densities, Allen deviation curves, and residual curves.
May I ask about, because you didn't explain explicitly, what's the measurement principle? So you're measuring the extraction
okay,
of the
laser? Sorry, yeah, here's the measurement here. Okay, so I was just about to explain that. So you have a cryogenic oscillator, which is a roughly 12 gigahertz. You have a hydrogen maser, which outputs 100 megahertz signal. Because when you usually get a hydrogen maser, it's already engineered for 100 megahertz output. So that is multiplied up to 12 gigahertz, and then the difference between them is about 67 megahertz, and then that's further beaten down to a counter where we're reading out 65 to 63 hertz. And you see here, this is 63 to 65 hertz here in this period, which is from the 26th of March to the 3rd of August, 26th of March 2003, 3rd of August. And this is taking a measurement every 100 seconds. You're taking a measurement every 100 seconds, okay?
And we have a timestamp with respect to UTC.
So the physical mechanism is that you expect an effect on the cryogenic oscillator.
I don't know what we expect. What does anyone expect? Us, the theorists. But I'm doing a measurement and looking for a signal, okay?
The physical mechanism is that you believe that there should be no noise in the frequency of 1 year, and especially the noise with a particular phase. If you believe that there is no noise, you can check it.
You want me to explain local positioning variance? What it is, we have two different clocks. And if we believe in relativity and everything, it's independent of the mechanism of the clocks, how gravity should affect them. But maybe there's something inside the clocks that work on different principles, like grand unified field theory type things, whatever the theorists can tell us. And so when the clocks will actually tell different time as gravity will change. And so we can measure if gravity affects the clocks in the two ways, and that's a local position invariance test. It's a null experiment. And so we're looking, and there's been a lot of these types of experiments in the past, starting with Tanner from Stanford, whose first experiment was a cavity, superconducting cavity versus a hydrogen maser. I think it was a hydrogen maser. And that was done at 10 to the minus 2. And the only other cavity that's been tested was by Stefan Schiller, who did a round a little bit worse. 5 by 10 to the minus 2. But you'll see at the end of this where 2 orders of magnitude better for a resonator experiment, which is 10 to the minus 4, which is not as good as the atomic clocks, but it's good for a resonator experiment. But I believe that this has got some advantage over the other data I've seen. A lot of the data I've seen from atomic clocks are really, they're like measurements. And they're trying to get accurate measurements, where for this you only really need relative measurements and continuous to get better signal to noise. So you don't care about accuracy. Accuracy is for the drift, I guess, for the drift in front of, oh well, that, I guess that's really relative as well.
So yeah.
I'm not sure I totally agree, Mike. It seems that if you know the gravitational potential change, I mean, that's not something that you can get away from, how the Earth goes around the sun.
No, you're not.
Then you can look at the nodal positions or the anti-nodal positions, and you don't need to look in between.
Yeah, but I think it's good to look in between. Just the statistics.
Statistics is true.
Yeah. And that's why I left off the data way down in 2002. There's a large gap. And when you're trying to fit a sinusoid, you know, there's all that space in between with all those oscillations. And I don't know. It's just, I mean, I'm not sure. I just, to me, the feeling is having all this. Well, I'll let you keep going, because it's like a Lorentz violation test. We have a lot of data, and the statistics are good. And in this experiment, we have a lot of data, and the statistics are good. That's what I liked about when I was analyzing the data, when I look at some of it compared with some of the other experiments, where they just sort of take a measurement every now and again, and it's a bit scattered. So let me continue. Frequency is sampled every 100 seconds. To look over, of course, I've got a hell of a lot of data. And if anyone was looking at my computer while I was sitting in some talks, they would have seen me looking at lots of data. But I was listening as well. I can do two things at once. But just like a lot of you guys. So what I did is I averaged over a bigger interval, which was 1.1 days, to reduce the data sets. And when I'm looking over a year, it's good to average down. The noise is white, and then the residuals are a bit more compact when you look at them, instead of spread out all over the place. So there's two ways the data is analyzed. So if you look at this, the red is the data, the black is a quadratic fit. And later on I'll show you why I did a quadratic fit, because it really is a quadratic, the data. But you see, you can see actually here, if you look hard, there's little jumps. And that's because we've got a cavity. When you relock and you put the liquid helium back in, there's little jumps in frequency. And when you're fitting and subtracting, that's the biggest effect on your statistics. So I was thinking that there must be a better way to do this, because the slope is actually got nicer statistics. So then it came up with the idea that we'll look at the derivative and try and get the signal out of the derivative. That'll give us better statistics. Okay, maybe for an atomic comparison of atomic clocks, this is not such a problem, because you don't have as large a drifts between stopping and starting, because it's an atomic transition and more well-defined the frequency. So here's an example. These are the residuals between the quadratic and the data, the absolute residuals. And you can see there, it's not really satisfactory. And you know that when you look for things in that, it's not going to be very satisfactory. But nevertheless, you can go ahead. And what you do is, you can, because we've got a lot of data, we take a spectral density. And we can see that it has an F squared dependence. And you can see that in the Allen deviation too, when you look at the residuals. Okay, so that's good. And so what do we do then when we're going to look for a signal? We use weighted least squares, because weighted least squares, we can take into account the power spectral density. So it will weight. If we look up here, there's more noise. You can see more scatter over the low frequencies due to these systematics. And the other way to look at the data is the derivative. When we take the derivative, now we're looking for changes in slope. So we take the derivative of the gravitational potential, and we can fit for that in the derivative. When we take the derivative of the data, those jumps go away. Okay, so we don't have those jumps there anymore. And we've got much more sensitive way to look for the signal. And you can see here, yeah. I just get on collider graph and say derivative. And the whole row fills up, and I've got the derivative. But no, you just take the derivative of the data, you know, you've got the...
I mean, do you remember it?
Huh?
It's a numerical derivative.
Yeah.
So you can have a number of points that you can choose. You can integrate it over, you know, 10 points or 100 points or 2 points.
Now, what I did is I averaged the data first. And so then I get up to separations of 1.1 day in the data. And then I just, you just take the frequency and the time difference, and it gives you the derivative.
So just 2 points?
Yeah. Simple as that. That's all you need to do. And what you see here is we get exactly what we expect. We know that the thing is drifting at about 1.5 by 10 to minus 13 per day. And that's exactly what we get. But you see, I didn't realize this before. We thought it was constant, but there is a slight slope here. So that gives me the reason I can take a quadratic off the data. It actually is quadratic. Where when I was looking at long-term stuff before, when I didn't look at the derivative of the data, I thought it was linear. But it's actually a slight quadratic there. So then we subtract that off and we get the residuals we want to look at. And then when we take the power spectral density of the residuals, it is white, and we look at the Allen deviation of the residuals, it's a normal root tau. So we can say it's white, and because it's white, for this, we use ordinary least squares to check out the data. So the data analysis, we've got, if we're looking for the absolute no derivative, we look in phase, and just for fun, I look at out of phase. Maybe some theorists can get an imaginary response and get an out of phase response from a gravitational potential. But we look for, I look for both, because that probably tells me more information. And for the derivative, I use ordinary least squares, but of course I have to bring this here, out here, and I can look for both signals. I'm telling you, I'm also looking for diurnal signals, because we've got such good statistics, I'm looking for diurnal signals as well. I was hoping to get it finished, but I haven't. I'll get it finished after the conference. Probably two more days. If I was 2 days later, I would have had that. So we look here, when we do our weighted least squares, I look at the standard error, the sum of the in-phase and out-of-phase and the amplitude for both. And you can see for the derivative, the statistics are pretty good. Sometimes it's above and below the standard error, which is sort of what you'd expect. Here it's a little bit above, but not too far above, only a factor of 1 point something. And you see that the amplitude follows, because it's weighted least squares, the standard error drops as the frequency increases, and you can see that this amplitude drops as well. So that what that tells you is there's nothing really significant. It's just that the data's probably non-stationary because of all those systematic jumps, and you see in the residuals that they're not very nice. So we always assume our noise is stationary, don't we, inherently in the statistics we use, but probably it's not. And the frequency, of course, is this radians per day. I'm using everything in units day. So what did we get out of the weighted least squares and the ordinary least squares? Well, the intuition of the derivative being better was true. We got a much better result, both in A and B, if you look at the standard error. Okay, that's because we got rid of all those systematics to do with refilling the cryogenic oscillator. And anyway, I look for both, and I can take the weighted mean of them both and then divide by this factor of 1.6 by 10 to the minus 10. And in the end, I get the order of 10 to the minus 4 for A and B, on the order of 10 to the minus 4, which is not bad for a resonator experiment. The diurnal effects, the statistics are even better because a cryogenic oscillator has much better statistics, much better stability on that order. And you will find after doing that, I'll add that into this table. But however, of course, the variation is a couple of orders of magnitude lower. I'll just reiterate that we left out the data before March 2003 because of larger systematic shifts. I could include it in the derivative, but I didn't bother. It won't make much difference. And the small duty cycle. We have a lot of data after August 2006, and that's yet to be included. The guys from Paris will send me the data, and I'll do the analysis. And
probably have that for the SFSM conference. And in, so in the end, we'll have 5.4 years in total. And in that analysis, so that's my plans. And probably that'll improve the results a bit more. And I don't expect, we don't see anything really significant above the standard error. So compare with other resonator experiments. The first one was the, of John Tenner, who put a limit of 1.7 by 10 to minus 2 with a hydrogen maser and a superconducting cavity. And Stefan Schiller's group, which had iodine and a febrifuge, which is 4 by 10 to the minus 2. So compared to other resonator experiments, this is a couple of orders of magnitude better. But compared to the atomic clock experiments, of course, you wouldn't expect it to get quite as good because of the over a year and a day, a cryogenic oscillator starts to go up in noise. Is that result useful? Well, Victor did this calculation. He worked out that, well, a while ago I did a calculation on how a CSO depended on the fine structure constant, and doesn't it only does when it's near a phonon frequency or a paramagnetic resonance. And so the ratio of these two will give you some dependence like this. So I'm not sure if these results can be useful amongst comparing for local position invariance to see if any of those vary, any of those variables vary with gravity. Okay. Now I go on to another topic. I don't know if anyone wants to ask any questions about that topic.
So that's a different test. Local position invariance or dependence on gravity?
That's local position invariance.
If you have in mind dependence on gravity, you know the phase. For the signal, you know when the potential.
Yes, yeah, so I'm doing it with respect to the gravity potential.
If you don't care about gravity, you don't know the phase.
Yeah, well, I did analyze the outer phase as well.
But if you care about gravity, I think that just Peirce experiments, when you have rotational Peirce, could be more convincing.
Yeah, well, I'm doing those as well. I've analyzed some of the data. It's not ready to present. I would have presented that. The next conference, I will present the diurnal analysis.
If you care about gravity, that means that redshift should be, cellular redshift of the light should be changed.
Yeah, so it's a differential
redshift. Yes, but in quite visible level. So because if you change gravitational potential of potential for an atom, that's a redshift. What you claim is that comparison of redshift in respect to different clocks will produce the different result.
That's right. So now it's.
Yes, but I think that the accuracy with which people measure the redshift is rather such high that we should not expect difference between different clocks in this level. Otherwise, the redshift will be changed too much.
Probably right. I think what is.
Of course, instead of your experiment, we do a virtual experiment. We have two clocks here, two clocks there, to compare the redshift, and we will see that from point of view of one clock, we see one value of the redshift, from point of view of another clock, we should report another value of the redshift. So in a sense, what you say, if it's related to gravity, is that you believe that redshift depends on clock, which we apply. Yes?
Probably.
And in this case, redshift agrees with theory in a certain level of accuracy, where it should not be different with clock, because with the redshift, we don't care about clock in a conventional theory. And that means that at the level where the redshift well agrees with theory, we believe that energy transitions should not depend on gravity. Different. It should depend on universe.
So really, what do you want to tell? It's accuracy 10 to the minus 14. Who measures shift accuracy 10 to the minus 14?
So you're seeing that the gravitational effects are just three orders of magnitude, differential gravitational effects, three orders of magnitude are smaller than conventional. So that's what you mean? Because the redshift was measured with quite high accuracy.
No, but it's accuracy 10 to the minus 14. It's not about redshift anymore.
10 to the minus, okay.
The result is divided by change of gravitational potential, which is 10 to minus 10. So after that, you have 10 to minus 2.
Yes, but still, what is the accuracy of the relation?
10 minus 5, or?
10 minus 5, 10 minus 6.
That means that this is an accuracy 10 to minus 5 or 10 to minus 6. All clocks should respond to gravitational potentials the same way.
Well, any test.
Otherwise, we would have a problem with measurement observation.
But it's far. Atomic clocks measurements are far better than any astronomical measurement of gravitational redshift. So, I don't know.
What you mean? Measurement of redshift, yeah. So, as long as we can compare clocks, we see no problem with redshift. That means that somehow there's no gravitational effects beyond the conventional theory, which are detected.
A couple of motions on top of all of that. I just put. It's not really something you can try to measure accurately. It doesn't matter compare any other stuff. Whether you measure redshift.
Well, I don't care about that.
I'm talking about redshift measuring the same experiment, but it's not something you even bother to try to get particularly right. It doesn't matter. So, because there's so many, you saw the width of these velocities of talking systems, it's so broad. That's a very big delta redshift in that regard. So that's a different story. It's due to astronomical velocities.
What's the accuracy of redshift from solar spectra? To what level can you measure gravitational redshift in solar spectra? Is that what you're asking about? Because in that case, at least you can quantify the redshifts, and you can quantify the everything but gravity, and then you know what the gravitational potential is there as well.
People certainly measure the gravitational redshift, but it's hard to distinguish from other effects.
From Doppler.
All sorts of other effects, right. Like other Doppler effects.
Yeah, so it's not so precise.
And clearly measured gravitational redshifts are around black holes. Mm.
Yeah.
But the lines, ion lines, it's ray. I don't know.
So, okay.
Okay.
Now we'll proceed further. Because I am not sure you understand the question that you're asking.
Just
we'll discuss it later.
When you study the field of the redshift, it's rather proves that you don't have relatively big gravitation-dependent effects. And there are many tests of universality of the redshift. Even when we look for absorption spectra of quasars, trying to say that they depend on alpha variation of tail, we see that basically the results are the same. We have also laboratory experiments where we see the redshift is universal.
No, but this is a kind of experiment. This is exactly experiment you talk. It's laboratory experiment to test the universality of a redshift. It's exactly what was talked about.
That's right.
Yeah, besides, okay. Experiments directly related.
So the best experiments. So there will be Dima Butker talk and maybe about this. You can compare clock to clock experiment. There's no point to compare anything else because nothing is comparable.
But this was the best clocks.
No, it's. I had up here the best that I know is this experiment, which compares. Hydrogen mass with the cesium and 10 to the minus 6. But the idea is that different clocks, it depends on the. You have to compare different clocks because they may have different dependence. And if I compare with other resonator experiments, this is two orders of magnitude better. But if you compare with the best one that I know of, maybe someone else knows a better one.
Compare with cesium clock, which is so far. One of the best in the world. The Paris Observatory. His resonator is a part of a cesium experiment in the Paris Observatory.
That's
so it's basically it's comparison with cesium clock, the best cesium clock.
Yeah, it's
that's
not
so important. Since they look at particular frequencies, they remove the drift, so they do not need the best clock in a sense. So it's not important.
So there are no other competitors, basically. You're talking, again, yes, it's a test of universality of redshift, but there is nothing better.
Anyway, I'll continue. Mm-hmm. We can continue talking about this, except I'm an experimentalist.
No, but it's indirect.
So the other experiments we're doing is test of Lorentz invariance experiments, and that's one of our experiments, which is the Michelson-Morley experiment. And so there's two tests of a Lorentz invariance that we're doing, and one uses cryogenic sapphire oscillators, and that's if we compare to the standard model extension, that's called an even parity test, and an odd parity test, we've also worked out how to do one of those. So why test Lorentz invariance? Well, the theorists know. I'll just show you this and say what I usually say, that you know, something might occur on the Planck scale. We heard a talk this morning, of course. And that might mean that you might get a positive signal in a Michelson-Morley type experiment or a Lorentz, trying to test Lorentz invariance. And we use the mathematical framework of the standard model extension and Robinson-Mansuri-Sexel framework as well. So we're testing light, but we're also testing matter too, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'll just talk about the photon sector. Basically the photon sector is parameterized by this standard model extension, which virtually gives your D and H and EMB fields this tensorial relationship with these kappa matrices, which are your Lorentz violating components, so that the medium sort of looks like a crystal. And you have these even and odd parameters to test for and a scalar parameter. And there is other terms which are polarization terms which have been tested by astrophysical sources, and they're much better, they have much better limits. But the even terms about 10 to the minus 6 and the odd terms about 10 to the minus 12. And before we started analyzing this, no one knew how to try and measure the scalar term.
Parameterization. Could you please explain what you actually measure?
What we actually measure?
What correlates with what?
Okay, I'll continue to step. Let me skip this. Well, here's the sapphire. First, I'll try and get there when I talk about the modulations that we see, okay? The UWA sapphire clock is what we use, and in these resonators, we have whispering gallery modes, and they oscillate around the crystal, like so, the standing waves. So they're, as whispering gallery modes do, oscillating around the perimeter. So what happens is that we rotate in the lab, we have two resonators, and we compare frequencies, and as what you suppose these Lorentz violating fields are like background fields. And so it's like at the Planck scale, an ether at the Planck scale. That's like how I like to think of it. Maybe some of you theorists have got a better description, but it's like an ether at the Planck scale. So this is background. And we look with respect to the sun-centered frame. We look for modulations with respect to the sun-centered frame. And there's a whole pile of components. And when you put them in, when you do the calculate the modes in your cavity, and you look at what modulations you'll get using perturbation theory, basically, you see you'll get these modulations as we rotate around some absolute frame. You'll get the rotation frequency offset by the annual frequency and the rotation and offset by sidereal and twice sidereal. You're going to get modulations at these frequencies. So here was our first experiment.
What do you compare with what again?
We compare these two. We compare the frequency of these two cavities.
So these two cavities, they have different orientation.
Different orientation, like an interferometer. You see, they're pointing like this. So
orientation this way and this way.
That's right.
And they're exactly the same in every way, more or less.
Well, it was exactly the same you can get. They were machined out of the same bull. They've got pretty much the same properties, the same Q factors. The frequencies are offset by 200 kilohertz out of 10 gigahertz.
You assume that there is modulation with rotation of Earth and rotation around the sun, yeah?
And the rotation
in the
lab.
So ratio of frequency changes when Earth rotates,
yeah,
and when Earth rotates around the sun.
Yeah, and we rotate in the lab as well.
You rotate on the lab.
So you can just turn it as well.
We turn it as well. You're going to see a video of that.
So it's a directional differential frequency, yeah?
Yes. It's Michelson-Morley experiment. That's classic Michelson-Morley experiment. There's the experiment. It's we were lucky to have Frank Van Camp, who was building gravity gradiometers, and he wasn't using this. He had already this setup where he used to just go right angles, so we just readjusted the rig and made it rotate continuously, put some vibration isolation in a typical Australian limited budget, and got it bang everything together and use some old resonators in the lab. Got a rotating connector up the top. And so we had the oscillators, cryogenic oscillators made that with stable frequency in parts from 10 to the 14. The beam frequency is made at 226 kilohertz and goes through a coax cable rotating connector. And power goes through this way too. So there's electrical connections on the outside of the connector, which brings the power in, and in the middle there's a coaxial cable which comes out, which is then countered by a frequency counter. And we have monitors for monitor systematics, and we measure the frequency every pi on 6 degrees. So we know the orientation. We've got to keep track of the orientation. So we took over a year of data, and we knew in any bit of data you can say which way the experiment is orientated. So here's the experiment rotating.
How often does that happen?
Huh?
How fast is that?
Well, it's rotating. In this experiment, it rotates once every 18 seconds.
So what we're actually seeing is real time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's real time. Start hearing music soon. So this was an art.
No,
it could be. You wouldn't know, would you? It's rather interesting. So you can see this. Yeah, okay, and there's a rotating connector. So the fractional frequency stability for these resonators on the order of 10 to the minus 14, they weren't the best resonators we had. We thought we'll just get the experiment together, and if it works well, then we can get to 10 to the minus 16s. And we've finished this experiment, and we're now building the next version of the experiment, which will be down here, which will give 1.5 orders of magnitude better. So I don't think I'll talk about the data analysis. So let me just show you this. This gives a brief summary. This shows you Michelson-Morley experiments over time and how they got better over the years, starting from 1880, and as the delta C on C. And the Brillet and Hall really started these new version of experiments, the cavity experiments, and then ourselves with the Paris Observatory and the German group did some stationary experiments, and then we went on to the rotating experiments, and these were our, I know the Germans have done a bit better now, but no publications have come out, but until that publication comes out, we have the best test. And in the future, we plan to be down here when we do our next version of the experiment. And this is our next version of the experiment, where we're using a much bigger sapphire with a much higher Q factor and with stability into the 10 to the minus 16s. I'm near the end, aren't I? I should finish soon. Okay, so I'll quickly mention the other experiment, which is an odd parity test. And what it does, this is it. What in between making the other experiment, we in Australia we don't leave our resources lying around. I get another experiment going, and this is a microwave interferometer in here, which is like a one-way test, which is rotating. Let's skip past that. And in the so-called odd parity test, instead of being at twice the frequency, we get signals at the rotation frequency and offset by the annual frequency. And that's because it's like a one-way test.
So what we determined is that an asymmetric interferometer would be sensitive to this, and it's because it's a one-way, it's a Max Edner interferometer. It's one whole rotation. You must do one whole rotation before you get back to where you started. That's why, where in the Michelson-Morley, you do a half rotation and you're back where you started. You're testing this way and this way. So a Michelson-Morley, classic Michelson-Morley experiment gives you signals at twice the rotation frequency, and this one gives you it one times. But the fact is, it's what we're trying to measure is the scalar component. And because I'm running out of time, I won't bore you with all these details. I'll just show you the experiment again and get to the results. Well, here's the, we found we had to do magnetic shielding. Here's the microwave interferometer. It was funny because when we came up with this experiment and we realized we needed a microwave interferometer with permeable material, we'd been developing microwave interferometers in our lab for a long time for more commercial purposes, for low phase noise devices. So it was just natural to use this technology for a test on fundamental physics. So the commercial sector can help you in the fundamental physics sector and vice versa. And I'll cut a long story short. We can look, of course, at the rotation frequency, there's a systematic, but we're looking at offset by one on a sidereal day, and around there we're not influenced by the systematic. You can see that the standard error and the amplitudes that you get at these frequencies are not influenced. So that's good. We can get data away from our systematic. That's the same in the rotating oscillator experiments. And in the end, we put a limit on this scalar Lorentz violating parameter on the order of 10 to the minus 7, which is about the same as the Ives-Stiller experiments. Okay, so I can finish there since I've run out of time.
Can you explain again this terminology, even a log parity?
Yeah, okay. So these Lorentz violating parameters, the way I look at it is it's to do with the symmetry of the tensors, the Lorentz violating tensor, the even and odd parity tensors, okay? So when you go back to that Maxwell's equations, which have got the Lorentz violating terms, there's these kappa terms and they're matrices, they're 3x3 matrices. And the matrices are either even or odd, three by three matrices, I think, or four by. And then the way I look at it is the even ones are actually even because, well, it takes when it's an even experiment, it's like Michelson-Morley, you go half a rotation and you're back to where you started. The odd ones are one rotation. So as a experimentalist, that's the way I look at it.
Right.
So Ives-Stiller experiments are one-way, used to be called one-way speed of light experiments. They're sensitive to this. They're an odd experiment too. We realized that before anyone knew how to measure kappa trace, that we realized that and published that in 2005. Okay. And so you can use the Ives-Stiller experiments to put limits on this.
So can you say that odd parity means that you are measuring speed of light this way and the opposite, and the even you measure this way and perpendicular way?
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah.
I have another question. So you're talking about modification of Maxwell's equation.
Yes.
So I'm wondering how much room for that is left by some other experiments. For example, if photon has a finite mass, then you have to use, you know, Prakar equations that also modify Maxwell's equation.
But it doesn't violate gauge invariance.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the best limits on photon mass come from the magnetic fields in the universe.
Which is famously overpushed by 21 years of magnitude or something.
By whom?
By the people who publish this. Because if you do it properly with the heating of the photon.
I'm talking about Rutov's work?
Well, can discuss. I mean, it doesn't relate to.
Well, my question is there room for modification of Maxwell's equation at the level that you are?
I think that's a question for Alan Kostolevsky. I know he was looking.
Well,
into
more importantly, there are very very precise tests with spins, right? Like the ones that Steve was doing, right? And if you have some corrections to photon distortion, right? At some level, we think the nucleus are always photon, right? Like many cubes. So this would translate into the coupling of nucleus with these directions. And usually, those experiments, like comparing cesium to mercury, have said very, very strange.
And so,
my
stronger.
Any other questions?
I have a very.
Michael wants to retire. You're not allowed here.
That's all right.
We'll have 2 minutes break. Don't worry.
Yeah.
We're not such a fire. So changing something.
When you rotate this thing,
yeah.
How parallel is your axis to the local gravitational field?
What we do, I don't know how parallel it is, but what we do is we can tilt every axis. And what we do is we look at the systematic and we tilt it until it becomes minimum.
Right, but sometimes you could rotate it a little bit at an angle.
If you have this angle, you go
there. Could do some effects, not necessarily.
Yeah, well, if you do it on an angle, you'll generate more systematics through the tilt, because these things have a tilt sensitivity. And so what you practically do is as you tilt it, you can see the systematic grow bigger and go down, and you minimize it, and then you get it going.
Well, it's also true that the local vertical is not in the direction of gravitational acceleration.
Yeah, the Germans have tilt control on that.
How do you define vertical when it's not in the direction of the local gravitation?
Well, we
so things don't fall.
Yeah, average the physical density of the Earth and point that way, or
well, yes, it's rotation.
It's Coriolis force.
Coriolis.
So you have a few degrees difference between the local vertical and the direction to the center.
No, we're talking about local vertical defined as
gravity.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.